It was Saturday night, and I'd taken a DVD out of Pearl Harbor. I was sitting down watching it, and I seemed to remember nodding off. I was dropping asleep, which was unusual for me halfway through. And then at the end, I stood up to turn the DVD player off and promptly fell over. My wife, who'd been sitting watching the film with me, turned to me and said, "How have you managed to get drunk without leaving the room?" Because that's exactly what it felt like. My speech was slurred and I was falling around. Though I didn't sort of feel drunk at all. And I just thought, oh, I'm going to bed. And the next day things got worse and it felt as if I was drunk again, and I began to walk into doorways. And I thought, this is it, I've got to go and see a doctor. So it was actually Monday morning when I went to see a GP, and I said to the doctor, "Is it possible to have a stroke whilst you're asleep and not know about it?" And she said, "Yes, it is, and yes, you have."
And then what happened?
On the Monday morning, I got to the hospital, I walked into casualty, I checked myself in, and I was seen by a doctor in casualty, who then sent me to the medical assessment unit. Now, to get there, I was put on a trolley and left there for about 5 hours. I'm convinced that I had my stroke lying on that trolley in a corridor, because I walked into casualty, but the next thing I remember is being in medical assessment, and I couldn't walk, and I couldn't talk, and my left arm didn't work.
So what had happened at Pearl Harbor?
I think it was happening on the Saturday and the Sunday were warning signs, which I just didn't know what they meant. And the main one happened actually when I was in hospital.
Mike Ripley talking to me about the stroke he had 3 years ago. And although he's made an excellent recovery, he'd be the first to admit that's more to do with luck than judgment. Taking to your bed, as he did, is the last thing you should do if you think you've had a stroke, no matter how minor. And nowadays, one would hope you wouldn't have been left on a trolley in a corridor for 5 hours either. Time is of the essence. Those first few hours are crucial.
If you look at somebody who has a severe stroke, every minute that goes by, they lose 2 million neurons. So time is really critical in terms of reducing the amount of loss.
Professor Gary Ford. At the moment, one in four stroke victims die within a month of their first stroke, and one in three of those who survive will be left dependent on others for at least some of their basic day-to-day needs. We'll be hearing more from Professor Ford on the latest treatments for stroke that, if given quickly enough, can save lives and significantly reduce the risk of being left with some form of long-term disability. And while the majority of the 125,000 people who have a stroke every year in the UK are elderly, strokes can strike at any age. I'll be finding out why 1,000 children a year have strokes and why the diagnosis is often missed. My guest in the studio today is Dr. Giles Durwood, who's a consultant in the stroke unit at Southampton General Hospital. Giles, what's actually happening to the brain during a stroke?
What happens to the brain is the blood supply to the brain tissue is interrupted, and brain tissue without a good blood supply rapidly degenerates and dies. The result of the death of the brain tissue is a loss of brain function, and depending where in the brain that takes place will give you the deficits that are obvious for people to see.
And that interruption is happening for what reason?
There are two main causes of stroke. One is due to a blocked artery supplying that part of brain. The other is a bleed into the brain tissue. Either way, the loss of function and the death of the brain cells happens, resulting in a deficit, and it's not easy to tell clinically between the two types of stroke.
So the blockage one we call ischemic strokes, the burst blood vessel, the leaking blood vessel, we call a hemorrhagic stroke. And you say you can't reliably tell the difference between the two?
No, clinically, from the story people give you, there are no clear distinguishing features, and that's why we're dependent on brain imaging to tell us what type of stroke someone's had.
So what are the basic symptoms? What should we be looking for? What might someone experience?
Typically, people experience a loss of function. So it may be the loss of use of one arm, the loss of use of one side of their body so they can't walk, the loss of speech so that they may know what they want to say but can't get the words out, the loss of symmetry of their face so one side droops. If it affects the posterior part of the brain, it may just be loss of coordination. So there is always a loss of function, and that's usually obvious to the individual.
I got an email here that's doing the rounds at the moment, and it's looking at, you know, trying to encourage people to recognise stroke. And it says, ask three simple questions. Ask the individual to smile, ask the person to talk or to speak a simple sentence, and ask him or her to raise both their arms. And presumably that's looking for the most likely deficit. You're likely to get a loss in one of those areas.
Yes, this is the basis of the FAST test, which has been promoted by the Stroke Association and is in use by a lot of ambulance services around the country, promoting the idea that stroke is a medical emergency and it can be easily recognised. And the FAST test, you look for symmetry of the face, you see if someone can raise both arms, and see if they can speak. And if you test all three and there's one or more of those features, then you're very likely to have had a stroke.
But we still don't know whether it's a hemorrhagic or an ischemic stroke, and we'll be finding out later why that makes a significant difference. But the idea is to get a diagnosis as quickly as possible. The only way you're going to be reliably able to do that, presumably, is through scanning.
Yes, there's the diagnostic test, which will tell you what type of stroke is a CT brain scan. And the sooner that's done, the sooner you have a clear diagnosis, which you can then implement treatments for.
Well, patients of mine, and I'm sure patients in your area of the country, will be used to waiting many months to get scans for non-urgent causes, for things like knee trouble. I mean, how easy is it to get rapid emergency access to the scanners that you need?
In most hospitals, CT scanning is available. It's upgrading stroke to the level of emergency and treating in the same way as someone coming in with a heart attack would be treated. Anyone coming in with a heart attack will get an ECG, a heart tracing, within minutes of coming in through the hospital door. Stroke should be in the same category because the newer treatments we have need to be given very rapidly to be affected.
Well, one of those new treatments is the use of clot-busting drugs, or thrombolytics. Originally developed to dissolve clots and restore blood flow through the blocked coronary arteries of people having heart attacks, clot-busters literally melt away blockages in the circulation to the part of the brain affected by ischemic stroke. Given early enough, before the damage to the brain becomes irreparable, they can save lives and prevent disability. Gary Ford is Professor of Pharmacology of Old Age at the University of Newcastle.
Patients who benefit are those who are treated within 3 hours, and the earlier they're treated within 3 hours, the better. The later we treat patients, this is even within the first 3 hours, the less benefit they're likely to get. So, for example, if you treat people within the first hour after their onset of symptoms with clot-busting treatment, for every two or three patients you treat, you prevent one of them being left dead or disabled, so it's very powerful. But the key thing is they've got to have an ischemic stroke, which is due to loss of blood supply to part of the brain because of an obstruction of an artery with a clot supplying the brain. And thrombolytic therapy, clot-busting therapy, works for the ischemic stroke patient and should not be given to patients who have a hemorrhagic stroke, since it will increase bleeding and make things worse. And for that reason, it's very important patients have a scan done as soon as possible after the onset of stroke symptoms.
But I can imagine that getting somebody into hospital, scanning them, getting the result of the scan all within 3 hours is tricky.
It's difficult, but most patients, if they have a significant stroke, witnesses nearby contact emergency services very quickly, usually by calling 999. And for example, in our own hospital, the average time that patients arrive at the hospital door when they contact ambulance services is just over 1 hour. So that still leaves quite a lot of time to be able to scan those patients, assess them and treat them within 3 hours.
And the hazard, presumably, is uncontrolled bleeding.
Yes, that is the major concern of treatment and why one has to select patients carefully who are not at high risk of bleeding. About 3% of patients get bleeding into the brain from clot-busting drugs, but the benefits of the treatment far outweigh that risk.
And what about other treatments in the pipeline?
Well, there are some interesting, exciting developments with what are called neuroprotective drugs, which again are being developed to reduce the damage from ischemic stroke. We've known for a long time from preclinical and laboratory studies that when the blood vessel to part of the brain is blocked, there's an area of brain where the blood flow is reduced. And if you can protect that with drugs, you can reduce the amount of damage that occurs due to secondary processes that occur in those cells which are short of blood, which lead to death of those cells. There are other advantages. One is that these drugs, if they're safe, which they probably will be in patients who have hemorrhage, can be given before you get a scan, so you can get the treatment on board much more quickly. And in principle, it would be possible to be able to give those drugs before the patient even got to hospital, that paramedics could give the drug, as they do for other acute emergency conditions.
Professor Gary Ford. You're listening to Case Notes. I'm Dr. Mark Porter, and I'm discussing strokes with my guest, stroke specialist Dr. Giles Durwood. Charles, it's good to hear about those sorts of advances, but in stroke prevention remains the key, doesn't it? How can we identify who's likely to have a stroke and what can we do about it?
Stroke has many risk factors in common with coronary heart disease that everyone's well aware of, such as blood pressure, smoking, diabetes, inactivity, and there are a few other more specific ones like an irregular heart rhythm, which can generate clots in the heart, which can get thrown off and get lodged in the brain.
Let's quantify those risks. But first of all, the one we haven't mentioned there was of course, having had a previous stroke, and that might not have been diagnosed, might it?
Yes, you can have previous strokes or mini strokes, so-called TIAs, transient ischemic episodes, where you have the same features as a stroke, you lose function, but that loss of function tends to be fairly short-lived, typically less than an hour. If that happens, then you are in a very high risk group for having a completed stroke or a more serious stroke. The recurrence risk at 1 week now is estimated to be around 10%. So you need very rapid access to diagnostics and definition of the risk factors to enable adequate prevention. And by doing this, we may actually prevent strokes happening.
And this is the people who've had TIAs, you know, in the past might have taken to their bed and thought, I just felt a bit funny for an hour or two, I had a bit of a funny head or dropped my teacup or whatever, and then they wake up and they feel fine. So they never even report it to the doctor, but it's a key sign because it could herald a major stroke on the way. What about high blood pressure? I mean, the figure I was always thought was that people who've got high blood pressure are something like 7 or 8 times more likely to have a stroke than somebody else. Is that the next biggest risk factor?
Yes, certainly high blood pressure in the community is the highest risk factor for having a stroke. So it's something that we can modify, and we can significantly reduce the incidence of first stroke. So these are the primary prevention means, the factors we can intervene in so that people don't have that TIA, they don't have the first stroke.
I've got a list here of some of the risk factors and the relative risk. I mean, if you're diabetic 4 to 6 times, if you smoke, we haven't mentioned smoking, of course, you're twice as likely to have a stroke. If you're sedentary, 2.5 times, poor diet, roughly 2 times as well. So there's lots of different risk factors there. But they're all, you know, we can identify those and they're good for lots of other reasons. Of course, the same risk factors often there for heart disease, another big killer. But what can we do about them? I mean, let's assume we stop somebody smoking and we get the inactive people active. What can we do with medicines and things that can actually intervene to reduce the risk?
Typically, people on stroke, people at risk of stroke, are likely to need intervention on multiple risk factors. So they will need the advice about smoking plus support in giving it up, but they're likely to need medications for treatment of their blood pressure, treatment of raised cholesterol, tightening up of their diabetic control if they're diabetic, and drugs such as aspirin to thin the blood, and other agents which may be added in addition to aspirin. So that people will end up on a combination of medications, each designed to intervene on one risk factor, and the combination should substantially drop their risk of having a stroke.
Well, age may be one of the biggest risk factors for strokes. Basically, the older you are, the more likely you are to have one. But children can be affected too. Around 1,000 children in the UK are thought to have a stroke every year, often for no apparent reason. Dr. Vijaya Ganesan is senior lecturer in paediatric neurology at the Institute of Child Health at Great Ormond Street.
Half of these children have another medical condition that predisposes them or puts them at higher risk of having the stroke. These would be conditions such as sickle cell disease or congenital heart disease, other sort of complex medical problems.
So these are problems that would predispose to clotting of the blood or sludging of the circulation.
Right, or abnormalities of the vessels. Yeah, exactly. But the other half of children are completely well prior to the stroke. I mean, in general, in terms of demographic terms, there are two main sort of peaks of incidence, one in the sort of preschool toddler population, and then again there's a rise in the sort of teenagers.
We know that in adults, the predisposing factor for most cases of stroke is narrowing of the circulation in the brain due to atherosclerosis. But that furring up process, although it does start depressingly early in life, surely it can't be a factor in children.
No, in fact, we don't really see atherosclerosis associated with childhood stroke. But in about 80% of children, we see abnormalities of the brain circulation. But in many cases, it's not really known why that happens. We think that factors such as infection are probably quite important, and specifically typically there is an association with preceding chickenpox infection, which people often find quite surprising.
I'm interested in the link with chickenpox. Is this something that happens during the acute illness, or is it a result of previous illness, complication that can happen months or years later?
Well, I think the thing to emphasize is that chickenpox is very common, and this is an extremely rare complication of chickenpox, probably affecting about 1 in 20,000 children who have chickenpox. It's an interesting association to us because it may tell us something about the mechanisms underlying stroke in this group. It can occur in the acute part of chickenpox, but there is an association with chickenpox within the preceding year.
And we think that's because it's resulting in some form of inflammation to the lining of the blood vessels?
Quite so, exactly, yes.
And what about the 50% who don't have any obvious identifiable cause? Do they share anything in common?
Well, I think these are children who are completely healthy, but when we investigate them, we do identify a range of risk factors which seem to come together in the individual child to cause a stroke. And those risk factors would be things like preceding chickenpox infection, anemia, for instance, other sort of factors like that.
So presumably in quite a few children, we never actually find an identifiable factor.
Disappointingly, that is the case, but I'm glad to say that as time goes on, that proportion gets less and less, and currently it's about 10%.
Well, let's look at the symptoms. What are the classic symptoms in children, and are they any different from those that we'd see in adults?
Well, the commonest symptom, as in an adult, would be a sort of weakness down one part of the body. But, you know, I think it's true to say that recognition is one of the major problems. A lot of parents say they, take the child to the A&E department where they may see a doctor who's not that experienced in dealing with children, and it can be quite difficult to think of stroke as a possible diagnosis.
And presumably, if you're looking at children, young children particularly, things like speech, affected speech, or even weakness in the body could be quite hard to elicit.
Yes, exactly. And some of those very classic symptoms you see in adults may not be apparent in babies or infants. And so, for instance, a child may just present with, inability to weight bear, inability to sit, seizures, something less typical than an adult presentation.
13-year-old Charlie had a stroke shortly after his third birthday.
When Charlie had the stroke and he was just running round playing and the next thing he collapsed on the floor, I remember running over, picking him up, his mouth had all dropped, and thinking, it looks like he's had a stroke, but obviously I thought, no way, like not 3 years old. And then we took him to Ealing Hospital, who done some tests, and they didn't think he'd had a stroke. They thought he might have suffered a fit or something. And then they kept us in there, and about 8 o'clock, he got out of bed and collapsed again. And that think that was the big one. So they needed an MRI scan. So off we went to Great Ormond Street, where they found out that it was a blood clot because of a narrow artery in his brain. All his left side of his body is very, very weak. But now he doesn't use his left hand at all.
Well, it won't open. He can't release it himself. And sometimes it goes up in the air. You have to, the other hand.
His left arm and his left leg's very weak. But he gets on well, don't you?
Yeah.
I think there's good data now to show that at least two-thirds of children who have a stroke have impairments in day-to-day life compared with their peers. And I think it's important to recognise that many of these would be relatively invisible to the casual observer. So, they may not have an obvious movement problem or an obvious speech problem, but relative to peers, they may have difficulties in terms of their school and educational attainments, or particularly in terms of emotional and behavioural functioning. But again, about two-thirds of children do have a movement problem, and that would be by far the most common sort of outcome after a stroke.
Dr. Vijaya Ganesan talking to me earlier. Giles, we should put this in context. It's quite unusual for children to have strokes. Presumably you get to see some teenagers in your unit.
Very rarely. I can think of one in the last 5 years.
OK. Assuming somebody has a stroke, we've done what we can for them acutely in the first day or two. What happens then? What can we do to encourage rehabilitation, to get them back on their feet?
We now think that rehabilitation should start as soon as someone enters hospital, because we're trying to prevent complications and promote an environment where recovery can occur. But we need to pay close attention to issues such as feeding, because a significant number of strokes have swallowing difficulties, and if that's not picked up at an early stage, people can develop pneumonias, and as soon as you have other problems, recovery is delayed. So rapid assessment of someone's ability to swallow is vital in their early rehabilitation.
Is this encouraging, you know, the part of the brain that's been damaged to repair itself, or is that finished now? Is it looking at other parts of the brain taking over tasks that were previously the responsibility of the damaged part?
The damaged part usually dies completely, and recovery is by a process of adaptation and recruiting of other parts of the brain to take over those previous functions, because brain dies very rapidly, and if you don't restore the blood supply to the brain, that bit of brain doesn't recover.
As a rough guide, in terms of recovery, looking at duration, if, for instance, somebody's still got a pronounced weakness in their arm at 6 months, does that mean it's going to be permanent? Can we look at these sorts of landmarks and decide when people are going to be left with a permanent disability?
The majority of recovery occurs within the first 3 months post-stroke, and if someone has weakness at the end of that period, they're likely to continue to have weakness. The degree of that weakness may vary, and we do see improvement 18 months, 2 years after a stroke. And so it's not the end of the process, it's the start of adapting to living with the effects of stroke.
Well, you mentioned swallowing there. We sent Leslie Hilton to a rehabilitation unit at Hope Hospital in Salford to find out more about their novel approach to helping people swallow normally again.
It's likely that around half of all patients who have a stroke will be left with swallowing difficulties. For some, this will be a short-term problem, but others will never be able to swallow. Patients have to be tube-fed because of the risk of food and drink getting into the lungs and causing infection. Pneumonia is a common complication for them. Lorraine Boyle was only 28 when she had a major stroke 10 years ago while working as a nurse. She regained consciousness to find a feeding tube up her nose, which she was determined to get rid of as soon as possible.
I couldn't swallow, so every day the dietitian would come and see if I could take anything, and I was always just coughing. So I used to have this tube, and I used to think, I've got to get rid of this tube. And in my mind, I said, there's so many people who had a stroke and who have a tube because they don't have their swallowing. So that was my first obstacle in my way, is to get my tube out.
Patients who lose the ability to swallow are the ones whose stroke has only affected the side of the brain responsible for that activity. That can be either side, depending on the individual. Dr. Shaheen Handy from the University of Manchester is researching how strokes affect the swallowing mechanism and thinks that the undamaged side of the brain can adapt itself to a certain extent to restore the ability to swallow.
Our belief is that the reason for that recovery taking place is likely to relate to how the brain is rewired over the course of time. Now, we've conducted some studies using a number of imaging modalities. The main one we've used is something called magnetic stimulation. And what we've found is that if you look at patients over time who show recovery in terms of their swallowing, there is some evidence to suggest that the side of the brain that was unaffected by the stroke, the unaffected hemisphere, shows recovery, shows some changes, a sort of reorganization, if you will. It expands out in terms of its representation for swallowing. And our belief is that that increase in representation is compensating and causing the recovery to take place.
Dr. Hamdi has invented a device to try and kickstart the swallowing mechanism again, and is running a clinical trial of it at Hope Hospital.
First of all, I'm just going to ask you to just relax.
Okay.
Now, this tube will go over the back of your nose, into your throat, and you're going to feel some discomfort as it goes down. So, as I pass this through, if you can just keep on swallowing. Keep on swallowing.
It works on the basis that swallowing is stimulated by feeling the sensation of something in the throat.
Okay, I think that's in the right position now. Okay, I'm just going to switch the box on. And I'm just going to turn the stimulator on now. And I'm just going to fire away a few stimuli. The technology that we're actually using involves the passage of a tube into the back of the throat. And the tube has electrodes on it which can deliver these stimuli, which are electrical. So a subject swallows this catheter, and if it's a stroke patient, then we usually pass it through the nose into the back of the throat. And most patients don't have a problem with that. It's not much bigger than a nasogastric tube, so it's reasonably well tolerated. It's then hooked up to a device that delivers the stimulation to the back of the throat, so a sort of low electrical pulses. And then we run that for a period of time, a few minutes normally, and we deliver that on a regular basis.
Dr. Hamdi's patients receive 3 to 5 sessions of the treatment, and so far the trial is showing around 1 in 4 people are getting long-term benefit from it. Patients who can't swallow can become socially isolated, and that can lead to depression. Anecdotal evidence shows that given a choice between being able to eat and drink, but becoming vulnerable to chest infections, or being tube-fed, most patients prefer to take their chances and enjoy their food. Maxine Power is a speech therapist at Hope Hospital.
The thing that they really do report most is a feeling of how heavily it impacts on all of their social life, because I think we all of us conduct a lot of our conversations with our friends and family around a meal table. And even where swallowing is recovering and where we can encourage people to do more, there's often a reluctance to actually eat and drink in public for fear of them coughing, choking, or not being able to cope, which I think is often a sort of hidden side of swallowing difficulties that we as clinicians maybe sometimes don't pay enough respect to.
Lorraine Boyle, in common with many other stroke patients, has learnt how to swallow again. She used her willpower and started with soft food like yogurt and rice. But the prospect of living on that forever drove her to eat a normal diet again, although she still has to be careful how she eats.
Everything's fine now. I can eat anything, but even today, I haven't, you know, say if I had a lunch and I might have just had it too quick, sometimes I've gone the wrong way, so it's into my lungs.
Lorraine Boyle talking to Leslie Hilton. Charles, let's end by summarising the gold standard management of a suspected stroke. First of all, what should the people, the public themselves, do?
I think it's the recognition of the symptoms that someone may have had a stroke.
But are the public, and our GPs in particular, aware that we should be now treating stroke as a medical emergency? I mean, people realise when they get chest pain now, they just dial 999. That's the right way to deal with that.
I think the public awareness isn't quite there yet. The Stroke Association have had a big publicity campaign that hasn't quite penetrated through yet.
This is the concept of talking about stroke as a brain attack, isn't it?
It's a brain attack. It's an acute medical emergency. It needs to be treated in the same way as a heart attack is. Get to hospital, get diagnosed, get to a specialist unit.
We're getting there, but must try harder.
Indeed.
Okay, Charles, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. Next week's programme is all about being too hot or too cold. I'll be finding out why we develop high temperatures when we're ill and what, if any, evolutionary gain they offer. And I'll be travelling to Oxford to discover how Viagra is being investigated as a possible treatment for the cold, painful hands and feet caused by Raynaud's disease.
Saturday night, and I'd
not
999. That's the right way to deal with that.
I think the public awareness isn't quite there yet. The Stroke Association have had a big publicity campaign that hasn't quite penetrated through yet.
This is the concept of talking about stroke as a brain attack, isn't it?
Brain.